Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what Republican presidential candidates are calling Obama's war on religion and what a growing number of women in America are calling the Republican war on women. Stephanie Sacchino, a professor of economics at the University of Vermont, who has done research on the role of religiosity in resisting and retarding gender equality, joins us. Then we will speak with Saul Alinsky's protege, Nicholas von Hoffman, about his mentor, who he worked alongside of for a decade as a community organizer on the streets of Chicago. Since Newt Gingrich continually calls Obama a Saul Alinsky radical, we will discuss Nicholas von Hoffman's new book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky, to determine what it is about this mother of all community organizers that has Cesar Chavez, Dick Armey, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Tea Party studying his tactics and strategies. Then finally, following a recent visit to Israel by National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, we will speak with author and Middle East expert Juan Cole about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's insulting remarks leaked to the Israeli press, where Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak accused an American war hero and chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, of serving Iranian interests. Joining us now is Stephanie Sacchino, who's a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Her current research explores the relationship between inequality, growth, and development, and explores the effect of gender equality on macroeconomic outcomes, with a recent paper investigating the role of religiosity in affecting attitudes about gender equality, as well as gender equality itself. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Sacchino.
Yes.
You've written a paper recently which basically looks into the role of religiosity and how it affects gender equality. Mm-hmm. Tell me, your paper's called Help or Hindrance, Religion's Impact on Gender Inequality and Attitudes and Outcomes. And the reason, of course, I'm talking with you is that we have very much in as we speak, of course, the presidential candidates are debating down in Arizona. But most of the Republican presidential candidates are calling, suggesting that President Obama is engaged in a war on religion. Mm-hmm. And conversely, a number of women in this country are saying that the Republican Party has a war on women. So that's the context. My understanding is that what your research has uncovered is that, first of all, the United States has a higher gender inequality, a worse gender inequality than other industrialized countries, and that there is a global phenomenon that the more religious a country is, the less gender equality there is. I mean, I take it that Saudi Arabia would be the exemplar of that.
Well, Saudi Arabia and others, but you stated it exactly right, that when we look at gender attitudes, and gender attitudes are revealed in questions like, when jobs are scarce, men have more right to a job than women. Men make better political leaders than women. Children suffer when mothers work outside the home. So those kind of questions reveal attitudes about what the appropriate gender roles are in society. And what we find is that the more religious an individual, the more gender unequal their attitudes. And then in this study, what was really surprising in this study and is unique to, in terms of research that's been done on this, is that those attitudes, those religious attitudes, actually convert into worse outcomes for women relative to men across roughly 60 or 70 countries. And you're absolutely right that in a number of indicators, the U.S. actually fares much worse than a number of other industrialized countries.
And no other industrialized country is having the kind of political debate that we're having here, I take it. At least I don't think. I mean, first, my understanding is that no other industrialized country even has debates abortion. Yet it's a major aspect of our political dialogue here.
Right. Exactly. And most other, just to give you an example of how this plays out in real terms, and most industrialized countries have paid parental leave for mothers as well as fathers. The United States is the only industrialized country without paid parental leave.
So what is it about the country? Is it to do with the original founders? Is that our DNA, the Puritans are alive and well in our DNA?
Well, I don't think that that's really what's going on in the United States. I think, in some ways, there has been some progress in gender attitudes, but I see that, in the last 20 years that we've really stalled, we've really failed to make significant progress. And that's coincided with the greater intrusion of religion into politics in the United States. And at least the analysis that I did showed that, that's one of the avenues by which religiosity has negative effects. It has negative effects on people's attitudes, such as employers, for example, but it also can have a direct negative effect on policies that might be gender equitable, like equal investments in women's education or in rural health care clinics that would benefit women or, for example, paid parental leave.
Well, but what's going on now, Stephanie Sacchino, again, professor of economics at the University of Vermont, who has done a recent study, Help or Hindrance, Religion's Impact on Gender Inequality in Attitudes and Outcomes. What's the most recent spat that we had and which led to this idea that on the part of the Republican candidates for president who often mention this, that they it's become a kind of campaign issue that President Obama is allegedly declaring a war on religion when in reality this all came out of the healthcare reform as it affects Catholic charities and hospitals or Catholic-run hospitals, and it's been blown up into a continuing war on religion, even though the president himself compromised. So let's walk through that situation. What seems to be inherent in that, and I guess inherent in much of what Rick Santorum represents, and in many ways it would be a good thing if Rick Santorum became the nominee, because I think we would finally have a test in this country about how pervasive and powerful religious dogma is in our politics. Because the assumption is, particularly on the part of people that are sort of nascent theocrats like Santorum, is that they represent the dominant view. And my feeling is that it's actually a minority view. What's your understanding of the kind of religiosity that both Santorum and also Gingrich represent? The attitude is that it's the minority, or at least the superior position, but it's not necessarily. I mean, I guess the disconnect is that the whole flap was over contraception, and it still remains the real subtext. Mm-hmm. But yet 98% of Catholic women use contraceptives. So, there's the disconnect. I'm trying to get is there any data on that?
I think that your data are accurate in terms of contraceptive use. I mean, I think that people hold conflicting views on this, and if you frame this as an issue of religious freedom, any time you use the word freedom in U.S. culture, people immediately are for freedom. And so if it's framed as government restricting religious freedom, then there's a lot of support for the position of the Catholic Church. But I think that, what's important for us to do is to unravel what's going on here. There's nothing here that requires individuals to do something that they don't want to do with their bodies. In other words, we're not requiring people to take contraceptives, for example. But what is happening is that the Catholic Church, for example, in its Catholic hospitals and so forth, doesn't want to cover contraceptive care. And there's this isn't about not wanting to cover it for Catholic women even. They don't want to cover it for any women. So in some sense, they're really circumscribing the rights of women who are non-Catholics. And what's particularly disturbing, I mean, I think it's really important to unravel these arguments and be clear about what's going on. The issue here is, in the new health care bill, institutions are required to provide preventative care at no cost, no additional charge. And contraceptive care is considered preventative care. So the church is essentially saying it doesn't want to provide preventative care to women, including those who are non-Catholic who don't necessarily share the same attitudes. Now, in my view, that's not a violation of religious freedom because it's not requiring somebody to do something with their bodies or break a rule about themselves that they don't hold. So I think that the arguments are really misplaced.
Well, it seems to me that that what's being argued here on the by Santorum and by the Catholic bishops is that they feel that their moral standards have to be imposed on the rest of us, as opposed to on the basis of a canard that somehow the government is intruding into their moral territory and forcing them to do something that's against their conscience, which is not the case, is it?
Well, I mean, I think you've said it much more succinctly than I did. I've thought about this, you know, I have been thinking about this great deal. I mean, you know, in many cases in the U.S., as in other governments, people may have private opinions that are biased, that are discriminatory, and they're allowed to hold those, but not necessarily in the public sphere. So employers are not allowed to racially discriminate, for example. And there are many cases in which religious organizations have held discriminatory attitudes towards various groups and so forth. And I think it's really a question of human progress and to what extent religious organizations that have ideas that really impinge essentially on human rights. In this case, it really is about human rights. Reproductive rights are human rights. And so is it okay for religious organizations to restrict those rights in the name of religion? Or as a society, are we going to say that, you know, in the privacy of your own institutions, you can hold those views, but you can't act in ways to circumscribe those rights when it comes to health care, when it comes to access to jobs, for example?
Well, we have, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Stephanie Sacchino, who's a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Her current research explores the relationship between inequality, growth, and development, and explores the effects of gender equality on macroeconomic outcomes, with a recent paper investigating the role of religiosity in affecting attitudes about gender equality, as well as gender equality itself, and the paper's Help or Hindrance: Religion's Impact on Gender Inequality in Attitudes and Outcomes. We've had, just in the context of this argument, this canard that's out there now that President Obama is involved in a war on religion, and you know Billy Graham's son Franklin Graham just was on MSNBC the other day reinforcing this pervasive notion amongst evangelicals in this country that, first of all, I don't know what the polling is, but a considerable number of evangelical voters believe that President Obama is not even a Christian, that he's a Muslim and an imposter with a fake birth certificate, and somehow he's from Kenya. But that aside, there's also this new attack from Franklin Graham and others. Not just that it's a war and he's conducting a war on religion, but also that he is a supporter of the Muslim faith because he's allegedly his father and his grandfather, etc., none of which is true, Muslims. So the general propaganda that we're hearing out here is the notion that this illegitimate president is conducting some kind of government jihad against religion. And in the real world, we've just witnessed something in Virginia which absolutely flies in the face of that, and in fact presents the opposite picture, which is at the behest of the religious right, the governor of Virginia tried to impose a very invasive procedure on the women of Virginia. Anybody who wanted to get an abortion had to have be subjected to a transvaginal ultrasound, which one is medically unnecessary and two expensive, and the expense has to be borne by the woman who's being forced to essentially have this invasive probe, which according to the FBI is the equivalent of rape. Look at the outcome, pay for it, and have it put in her medical file. Now, fortunately, a lot of women and men demonstrated, and the Republican governor, who's a protege of Pat Robertson's, apparently has sort of tabled it. Now they have a different version of forced ultrasound that is not quite so invasive, but nevertheless, women are forced into it. Isn't that a kind of textbook case of government intruding into the lives of citizens?
Well, I think that it is, right? And, you know, I mean, what's interesting is that much of what is propelling that is religion, right? There's a religious context to the view that somehow abortion should be circumscribed. And I think it's another example of, in this case, the religious right condoning government intervention. So they excoriate Obama for interfering in religious organizations through this health care bill that mandates contraceptive care. And at the same time, they're simultaneously intervening vigorously themselves in a way that they then argue is justified. And I think these anomalies and these contradictory stances really need to be brought to the light and discussed more cogently, and that we really need to begin to examine just how far religion has gone in interfering with life in America, and in particular in influencing public policy. And to me, it seems like we've gone a long ways away from the view that there should be a separation of church and state, and increasingly we're seeing a rather stealthy influence of religion on politics in the United States that I think is problematic insofar as that it really promotes, it contributes to gender inequality. With a great deal of research telling us that gender inequality is bad for economic growth, it's bad for living standards. So it ultimately can negatively affect all of us and the economy as a whole, and those contradictions don't seem to be understood.
Well, again, you just have to look at the example of Saudi Arabia, which has more money than God, and yet half of its population live in the 14th century and are not even allowed to drive. And it will never succeed as a modern state, even though it has some of the trappings of modernity. It's a strange. I don't understand the impulse of why men wouldn't want to hold back women. I'm sure. I wish somebody would tell me what that answer
well,
that question.
I think that feminist scholars.
I mean, I have a daughter. I simply cannot understand what that mentality is. Can you help me out a little?
Well, I think that many of us, especially amongst feminist economists, there's some really great work done by, especially an economist by the name of Alyssa Bronstein at Colorado State University, who has written on this topic. And I think the answer is that men benefit materially from gender inequality. They, on average, do less work than women globally, have significantly more power, significantly more leisure time, and, of course, significantly more income. And so I think there's a material basis to gender inequality. And I don't know how hard that is for people to digest, but, you know, that's economists would not be surprised at that, and that therefore motivates men to continue to perpetuate gender inequality.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Stephanie Sacchino.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Sacchino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont. She has a her studies, she studies the role of religiosity in restraining and retarding gender equality, and she has a recent paper, Help or Hindrance: Religion's Impact on Gender Inequality in Attitudes and Outcomes. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Sol Alinsky's protege. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas von Hoffman, a former Washington Post columnist and the author of Hoax: Why Americans Are Suckered by White House Lies and Capitalist Fools. His new book, just out in paperback, is Radical, A Portrait of Sol Alinsky. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas von Hoffman.
Well, thank you.
And you were a protege of Sol Alinsky's. You and he toiled in the fields of our Lord in Chicago as community activists for 10 years together. Clearly, Sol Alinsky is the godfather of grassroots activism. But he's actually been more, it seems, lately more appropriated by the right than the left. People like Dick Armey and the Tea Party have studied him. Of course, Cesar Chavez, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton wrote a thesis about him when she was in college. But that strikes me as something of an irony that the right is using his tactics. And what does it say about the left?
Well, I don't know. I think portions of the left may be slightly brain dead. The right can use this or that tactic, but what they can't do, of course, is appropriate the spirit, and that's the important thing. And I really don't understand why more people on the left aren't reading Sol and thinking about the kinds of things that not only that he stood for, but the way that he went about trying to attack problems.
Do you think in any way, though, the Occupy movement, Nicholas von Hoffman, has paid attention to him?
Well, I think the problem with the Occupy movement is that it at least at the moment, it has not gotten beyond being a very elaborate publicity occasion. It's not really an organization. And that, of course, you know, one of the things that Sol always said, you know, is either you have money or you have people, and you have to organize the people, or, of course, the money takes over and does the bossing. And that, the Occupy people have not really been able to get to the point to understand you have to organize the unorganized. You have to have organized power at the bottom.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas von Hoffman, who's a former Washington Post columnist and author of the brand-new book just out in paperback, Radical, A Portrait of Sol Alinsky. And we're talking about Sol Alinsky, who's been certainly revived by the candidacy of Newt Gingrich, who refers to President Obama as a Sol Alinsky radical. But as we've discussed so far, in many ways, the right wing have picked up on his organizing skills and used them, particularly Dick Armey and the Tea Party. And we're talking about the deficit on the left, if you will. I noticed here on the cover of your book, Radical, A Portrait of Sol Alinsky, that the American conservative is praising the book. So So they take it seriously. One of the adages about journalism, I guess it goes back to Mencken, I'm not sure, is the idea that the role of journalists are to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And clearly, in many ways, that's been turned on its head by the kind of corporatized journalism that we have today, and the naked propaganda machine of Fox News seems to spend all of its time trying to, in effect, stir up the Reagan Democrats and confuse them into voting against their own interests. And that's a powerful force, and I think it distinguishes so much of America from the other social democracies. It's, I think, the reason why we don't have social services in this country and the social safety nets that the other countries have. I mean, that's my explanation. What's yours?
Well, I think it's true, but I think also, you know, if you look at whether it's the New Deal or the trade union movement or civil rights, etc., when all of these things first blossomed, the media was always against it. And I think one of the things, of course, that made Saul such a remarkable tactician is that one of the things he knew how to do was to take adverse media and use it to the advantage of the cause. That, because Saul was not only an organizer, he was a wonderful tactician. And you've got to do that because, you know, what are you going to do? Fox is there. You know, you can bemoan it, but it's there. So you have to use it. It's what Saul used to call political jiu-jitsu. You use their strength against themselves. That's the only thing you can do because you're right. You know, these big institutions are not our friends, but we know that. So that's a given, and we have to work within that.
Well, I brought up the quote of the role of journalism is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable in the sense that Alinsky prided himself on being a disturber of the peace. And I thought that would apply to him in spades, you know, that notion. But just to point out the thrust of that earlier question, Nicholas von Hoffman, is that I find it extraordinary because I've been covering the Greek crisis. And at this point, in spite of all the austerity that's being imposed on the Greek people because of the reckless loans from German and French banks, the Greek people still have full and free health care, for example.
Yes.
We don't have anything like that. And the Republicans
and
are running.
They also have the idea that it should be a democracy and that they should not have to do what the people in Frankfurt tell them to do.
Right, but also we have one of our political parties running against a rather feeble and inadequate attempt to bring about health care reform.
Well, that's true.
That's true.
And now, of course, we have this very unfortunate cut in the Social Security tax, and I think it's interesting that the one Democrat that voted against it was Bernie Sanders.
Well, I have to say, he's a regular on my program and a breath of fresh air.
Isn't he wonderful?
And the longest-serving independent politician in America's history.
And he actually is
a socialist.
We should, what he has said about this, we should take heed with, because if it would be a real irony if the Obama administration is the one that decapitates Social Security, and that is a likely possibility because of this cut in the Social Security tax.
Well,
I
was going to say, though, Nicholas, that given both Santorum and particularly Gingrich's obsession with throwing the world socialist out, and of course they throw Hitler and Stalin out on a regular basis as well in their incredibly inflammatory rhetoric, but, you know, Gingrich is often refers pejoratively to socialists, and the idea that we actually have an exemplar, a real socialist in Bernie Sanders, I mean, it'd be great if somehow every time Gingrich refers to socialism, people in this country would think, well, that's Bernie Sanders. Maybe it's not such a bad thing because he's one of the few guys that stands up for the people.
Well, but of course, one of the difficulties that Bernie Sanders has is that he does not have a platform that can command the kind of attention that what he says should command. This is one of the great problems.
That's true. Well, Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas von Hoppen, a former Washington Post columnist, author of the new book, just out in paperback, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. Tell us a little bit about, how Alinsky used his social activism and political organizing in the sense that he found ways to get attention, often through humor. I'm reminded of the Yes Men, who I guess in many ways are perhaps a contemporary reflection of some of those tactics.
Well, I think one of the things that that he had, and which in a way still adheres to him, is that because he was effective, he scared the other people, and that brought attention to him. And then he could use that attention to build on. So, you know, he would say things such as, he'd go into a town where you would have a crisis, et cetera, where they were organizing, and these puppies from the, you know, the mass media would run out to interview him, and they'd say, what are you going to do, Mr. Alinsky? What are you going to do? And he'd look at him, and he'd say, well, I'm here to rub raw the sores of discontent. And, of course, that would send them off, you know, all the people downtown in the clubs, et cetera, into hysteria. And, of course, once you do that, once you have given your the other side the jitters, and fear has taken over, they begin to make tactical mistake after tactical mistake. And that's the kind of thing that Saul could do.
You know, we were able to get some tapes of Saul Alinsky here at KPFK. Upstairs we have the Pacifica Archives, and we found several hours of tapes, which we played, of Saul Alinsky speaking at the Smithsonian during the 60s, and clearly the audience is full of the anti-war demonstrators. And he's castigating them for calling the police pigs and spitting on and returning vets and really taking them to task.
Well, yes, he did, and for very good reason. Because, first of all, Saul did not believe that you use a noble cause to work out your own psychological problems. When a cause is important enough to fight for, it is absolutely necessary that you do everything possible to win. And you do not win if you go back in that period of time where you have young men coming back from war, conscriptees, draftees, who have been through hell and high water, under the flag of the United States, and you spit at them, and you call them nasty names. You don't do that. They did not go over there voluntarily. They were sent over there. So he understood that when you behaved that way towards the returning soldiers, that what you did was you turned people who otherwise would listen to you against you. And so that's why he castigated them. Saul thought clearly. He wasn't a sentimentalist, and he did not engage in these things in order to get some kind of psychological aggrandizement. These things were important enough so that you have to do everything to prevail, and therefore you have to conduct yourself with thoughtfully and with great self-discipline.
Well, the self-righteousness that you refer to, and I'd be interested to know from your obviously many discussions with Saul Alinsky, Nicholas von Hoppen, it's always struck me as being pretty clear that progressives and liberals would rather be self-righteous than effective in many ways. Conservatives don't care about ideological inconsistencies. They just have their eye on the prize, which is power. And I've often wondered why it is that you do have that disparity, that in many ways the left in America expects to lose. They continually mourn their martyrs and wonder about who shot Bobby, who shot John, and who shot Martin, while the bad guys are laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, I think that's true, but that was not Saul, because he didn't think that way. One of the things that he used to say is when, you know, you get into one scrap or another, because he was not a sentimental guy, you know, that was not part of his makeup. He would say, you know, in most fights, you're very lucky if you're 51% right. but you have to fight as though you were 100% right. And Saul did not go into fights to lose, and he detested moral victories. He detested martyrs, particularly because when you organize people, when you get them into a fight, when you are doing part of that, you owe it to those people to win.
And do you think that the American people will win? Do you think, you mentioned a little while ago Citizens United, how it should be the kind of galvanizing glue that gets the average American up off the couch and into the streets to demand redress? You know, there is a movement now to have a constitutional amendment, but that'll take years and a lot of effort in 2/3 of the state legislatures. So I'm just wondering how one could go about fulfilling that, in the sense that campaign finance is something of an abstraction in terms of political activism. It's not as clear as, say, slavery or women's rights or having...
Well, I think it's pretty clear, because, I mean, all you have to say to people is, look, if corporations are people, when one of your brothers, sisters is over in Iraq or Afghanistan in a platoon, do you ever see a corporation in the same platoon fighting? No, I think this is an issue that people understand absolutely at the gut level, that they have been had by a bunch of reactionaries, cat's paws for the billionaires.
Well, but the reason we have these corporatists on the Supreme Court is because, one, the fecklessness of the Democratic candidates for president, like Kerry and Gore. Gore, after all, won the election in 2000. And once he was elected president, the first decision he made was to concede unnecessarily. And that affects the Supreme Court. And I think a lot of people on the left are tired of the argument that you have to vote for the Democrats because of the Supreme Court. But the reality is, you do. I mean, if for no other reason, look what's happening. Citizens United and this corporate personhood is a fiction invented by the Supreme Court. It's no legislature, no president has ever passed this law. This came out of a clerk in 1886, out of a decision. And now these corporatists on our current Supreme Court are trying to extend corporate personhood through Citizens United to the First Amendment. And if they get their way, they'll extend it to the Fifth and the Fourth.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but, you know, I'm reminded of something that Finley Peter Dunn wrote, I think it must be 110 years ago, with that wonderful newspaper column that when he had this fictional Irishman, and he had a line somewhere that says, pardon my terrible brogue, but it was something like, the Supreme Court reads the election returns too, which is another way of saying they can be had if enough pressure is put on them. They can reverse their decisions. The whole history of the Supreme Court is one of their pulling back when enough pressure was put on them, and even to the extent, of course, you know, both Ulysses S. Grant and Franklin Roosevelt said, if no other way, we'll change this decision, because we will create new Supreme Court justices and put them on the court and outvote the people that are there. You don't have to, the whole business about constitutional amendments, etc., that would take forever, and it's nonsense. But you have to use power. Have to use power on the court.
And then people power, you're talking about. People power, right?
People power. You have to do it. You have to go after your Congress people, and you have to say to them in the community meetings, why aren't you standing up screaming about this all the time?
Well, you know, just in closing, Nicholas von Hoffman, we've had an example of how people power can change an incredibly mendacious law that was about to be passed in the Virginia State House.
Yes.
Thousands of people showed up. this governor was about to sign, and this governor, by the way, is a protege of Pat Robertson. He was about to sign a bill which would force women who are about to have an abortion to have an invasive transvaginal ultrasound, which, according to the FBI's definition of rape, is a form of rape.
Because it's
unconsensual and it's forced on them. And by the way, they have to pay for it, even though it's medically unnecessarily and counterindicated. And enough people showed up to stop these holy rollers from forcing their personal morality on the state of Virginia.
It can be done. It can be done. You have to have hope, and you have to have energy, and you have to have intelligence. But it can be done. I mean, listen, every time, every generation has to win freedom over again. You don't just get it. You inherit it and that's it. We have to do it over and over again. This is something that Saul believed very strongly. For every time, there is a new challenge, new work to be done. But it can be done. I mean, that's what our history shows, that we can do it.
Well, Nicholas von Hoppen, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I thank you for your book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas von Hoppen, a former Washington Post columnist and author of Hoax, Why Americans Are Suckered by White House Lies and Capitalist Fools. His new book, just out in paperback, is Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's outrageous criticism of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern, Middle Eastern, and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, where he has a new article, Israeli PM Netanyahu Attacks General Dempsey as Servant of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of to and fro between the White House and Jerusalem with visits, the Secretary of Defense, the Admiral Mullen, the former Joint Chiefs, and I think Dempsey as well. And then more recently, the head of the National Security Council, Danilon, went over there. Clearly, given the fact that the Secretary of Defense recently in a Washington Post article said that the Pentagon was concerned that Israel would attack Iran in the spring or the summer, and then Dempsey just the other day said it would not be prudent for Israel to attack Iran, it seems that at the highest level of the U.S. government, our top officials are signaling the American people that something's wrong.
Yes. Well, obviously, the Obama administration is alarmed at the way the Israeli leadership is talking about a strike on Iran and is putting enormous pressure, all the pressure that the executive can bring to bear on the Israeli leadership to let sanctions work instead.
So your article points out that in Haaretz, the major Israeli daily newspaper, the both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are criticizing General Dempsey and suggesting he's aiding and abetting the enemy, Iran?
Yes, apparently after the meeting with the National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, the Israeli government leaked the content of some of the discussions in order to make their displeasure known. And the way they put it was that to have a division between top U.S. officials and Israeli ones on how to deal with Iran served Iran's interests.
So they're suggesting that the very fact that there's discussions of these kinds are not helpful. But the reason that we're having these public leaks from or these public comments from our top officials is it would seem fairly clear that they want to inform the American public of the dangerous intentions of their ally over whom they don't seem to have any influence.
Right. Well, first of all, it is not acceptable that the Israeli leadership should speak in these terms of General Dempsey by his statement serving Iran. That's a charge of treason. And, you know, it would be possible for the Israeli leadership to say that they didn't think it was helpful to their cause for him to speak in those terms. But for them to use this kind of language, as was leaked to Haaretz, is a huge slap in the face to the United States, which, after all, gives Israel $3 billion a year in direct aid and then billions more in various forms of support, trade offsets, and so forth. So it just shocked me that the Israeli leadership would speak of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's a war hero, has deployed to Iraq three times, starting with the Gulf War. And, you know, the Israeli leadership kept saying that that Iraq was a danger to Israel. So Dempsey is somebody who should be seen in Israel as having helped their cause. To have them talk about him serving Iran's interest by his comments is just outrageous, diplomatically speaking.
Well, you mentioned that Dempsey's a war hero. He's been decorated with the Defense Distinguished Service Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster, the Distinguished Service Medal with three Oak Leaf Clusters, the Defense Superior Service Medal, the Legion of Merit with two Oak Leaf Clusters, the Bronze Star with a V device and Oak Leaf Cluster, and the Combat Action Badge and the Parachutist Badge. I take it what you're saying here, Juan Cole, is there's a distinction between insulting the head of the U.S. military and apparently it's a free-for-all in terms of insulting President Obama, right? The Republican candidates do it in the most vicious and arbitrary way. You've got Gingrich saying that he's the most dangerous president in the history of the United States. They seem to be totally free to say the most reckless things. So this is not the same as attacking the president. This is not a political attack. This is an institutional attack. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. It's also, I think it's intended to be personal against Dempsey. But this is not like internal politics. I mean, inside politics, obviously, if people are campaigning for an office, they will speak badly of their rivals. But this is between countries. Imagine what the reaction would be in the United States if the French President Nicolas Sarkozy came out and said that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was serving Iran's interests. There would be...
He'd be gone the next day.
I mean, it would just be absolutely uproar on Capitol Hill with denunciations of him. The current leadership of Israel is kind of out of control. They're talking about initiating a war, which inevitably would drag the United States in. They are handing out these insults and accusing their allies of more or less of treason. The military and intelligence professionals in Israel, as soon as they retire and come into public life, have in the last year come out and warned about the recklessness of this leadership. So it's very disturbing. But I think one of the positive signs here is that they are so upset, and it can only mean that they do feel boxed in by the Obama administration, that they feel that Dempsey and others are tying their hands, and so they're squawking about it.
So this does make you scratch your head, Juan Cole. Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He has an article at his blog, informed comment at juancole.com, Israeli PM Netanyahu attacks General Dempsey as servant of Iran. And, of course, the information is coming from the major Israeli newspaper Haaretz, where Netanyahu and Barak leaked their comments about suggesting that General Dempsey was acting as an agent of Iran. We're discussing what's going on with the generals in this country, the head of the Pentagon. Not necessarily what President Obama is saying behind the scenes and his discussions. And clearly it's got Netanyahu and Barak annoyed. But the interesting thing is that when Netanyahu comes over here in the beginning of March, coming up soon in a couple of weeks, to speak to AIPAC, you know that he's going to be enlisting the support of the U.S. Congress. So we have a peculiarly divided government here in the United States, where you have the professional military saying to the Israelis, for God's sake, don't do this. This would be a catastrophe. And you've got the U.S. Congress that will literally do anything that Israel says.
Yes, the Israel lobbies are enormously influential with Congress, and especially with this Congress. So the president is in a difficult position because Netanyahu can go behind his back, more or less, and appeal to Congress. And the current, you know, it's the most right-wing government Israel has ever had. And it, for reasons that I don't entirely understand, appears to be very interested in hitting Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities. The security professionals say that it's not a useful thing to do. First of all, the centrifuge technology that Iran is using can be dispersed, and so you can't actually hit it all. And you could set back their program, perhaps, a year or 2 years. And then there's no firm evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said recently that in the view of the American defense establishment, our intelligence agencies, Iran hasn't made that decision. It has a nuclear enrichment program. It's making fuel for its reactors. That is legal under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran has signed. UN inspectors were there when they recently reopened a medical reactor. The alarm and the decision to act that's characteristic of Netanyahu and Ehud Barak is puzzling. They're reacting to a crisis that hasn't yet occurred.
Well, the UN inspectors who've just been in Iran were denied access to a facility where there was a suspicion that they're doing weapons testing on igniting nuclear weapons and assembling them. So that doesn't speak well, that the Iranians refused to allow the UN to look at this facility.
Right. The Iranians, I think, are making a huge error in not allowing inspection of that facility. However, let's be very clear that based upon documents that many experts, including former International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, believe may be fraudulent. They may be like the Niger yellow cake.
Right,
green.
These are the documents that came from the MEC.
From the Mujahideen Khalq, the People's
right.
Holy Warriors.
Right.
The previous head of the IAEA had dismissed those documents as forgeries. The current one has put them into the report, and there's actually pretty substantial protest among the inspectors against this. And it's on the basis of those documents that they wanted to look at this military facility. It's not being alleged, by the way, that Iran is doing nuclear experiments there. But there are
chemical. I mean, they're a part of nuclear weapons is how you ignite them, and that's a significant part.
Could you make a strong enough box to have the subsidiary explosion in? Could you make a missile that you could put the warhead on? These are all ancillary things having nothing to do with actually making a nuclear warhead. The Iranians are not accused of that. But the UN is interested, based upon these documents, which, again, about which there's severe suspicion, in looking at that military facility. Well, the International Atomic Energy Agency doesn't have an implicit right to inspect anything in Iran. It has a right to inspect nuclear facilities.
Sure, but if the Iranians have nothing to hide, why wouldn't they let the inspectors in?
Yeah, well, the Iranians are prickly, obviously. But I agree with you, Ian. It's a big mistake on Iran's part. They should, in the current situation in the world, where the UN Security Council has voted sanctions on them, where the American government has organized a boycott of Iranian finances, where there's deep suspicion of their activities, they really are shooting themselves in the foot by not being completely transparent where they can be. I think they're on firm legal ground in not opening those facilities to inspection. It's their contention that they're not doing anything nuclear there. But just for the sake of appearances and to clear the decks, they should be letting those inspectors in. Apparently, the Iranians believe that they are in the course of further negotiations with the International Atomic Energy Agency over this issue, that the thing is not over with. But yes, I agree with you. This is stupid on their part, and it is also suspicious, inevitably.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com, where he has a new article, Israeli PM Netanyahu Attacks General Dempsey as Servant of Iran. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm